Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 30, Windows Media Center and Remembering HD DVD. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. My guest geek this week is Kevin Collins, a director in Microsoft's Custom Installation Channel in the connected TV business of the Entertainment and Devices Division. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hello, Scott. Nice to be here.
Thanks. Boy, that is probably the longest title I think I have ever read on my show. But I'm glad to have you on because I really want to talk about Media Center, which we will get to in a minute. But first, I wanted to do a walk down memory lane a bit here because I remember I was when you were scheduled to be on the show, I was remembering how we met. At the time, you were the HD DVD evangelist for Microsoft, and you contacted me, or someone from Microsoft contacted me, and you came down and held a meeting at what was then my video studio, which was called Grayscale Studio, and we had a bunch of AVS guys in, and you were demonstrating, there's a picture, you were demonstrating HD DVD to these AVS geeks, kindred spirits for sure.
Yes, that was a great time in my life.
And in addition, we were also demonstrating various video projectors in preparation for the big HD DVD tour that you were taking around the country. Why don't you remember with me a bit how were the early days of HD DVD? They seemed rather heady to me.
Well, the format war was, I think, a very unique experience for all of us that participated in it. It because of the internet and the ability to communicate with people on such a large scale, it really differentiated itself from when the previous format war of Beta and VHS was occurring. And, you know, there's just lots of the amount of internet activity and the religious tones that people took on the format war was something of something to was really something to experience. I was very fortunate to be able to be a part of that. And I can remember we went down to your place a couple times, one to test out and have some of the Hollywood studios come down to evaluate different projectors and the rear projection TVs that we would have as part of the HD DVD mobile experience. And then also we came down with Amir Majidimir down to your place to actually show shipping titles and shipping product and what the promise of the format had.
I remember you had a couple of notebooks with just about every single HD DVD release that there was. I was very impressed by that.
Yeah, I had every Blu-ray disc and every HDVD disc, and one of the unique enviable positions I had was the ability to get, quote, check discs from the studios where, you know, I would have access to those HDDVD titles quite a period before they actually came out to the general public to, A, test the interactivity and also look at the video quality. So that was that whole time period was probably the highlight of my career in terms of excitement and something around my passion around home theater and high quality video and audio.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that I was actually, I have to say, rooting for HD DVD. And one of the reasons was that it was introduced fully formed, right? Everything that HD DVD could do could be done with the first player on the market and the first discs on the market, whereas Blu-ray took, I don't know, a couple of years before they implemented, bonus view, profile 1.1, and then BD Live, You know, they took the position of, well, we better walk before we can run. But HD DVD sort of was all there at once, which I was very impressed with.
That was always some of our talking points that we had in regard to the format, was that everything in HD DVD was mandatory and specified up front. And we spent a lot of time with the studios, you know, working through all that. And, you know, unfortunately, everything came to what it was. And as a lot of people said early on, was, you know, does optical disc have the legs to, you know, survive? And, you know, Blu-ray's been taking off quite nicely. But because of the age we're in with internet and the ability to have digital downloads of media content, and the ability for, you know, new players like Netflix and Ultraviolet and those technologies coming, where people can have a digital locker and stream high def quality video and audio to their homes, elibit, not to the same level as what we experience on optical disc with HD DVD or Blu-ray, but still something that people can enjoy. Is really plays a big role in how we've seen this technology kind of come out and how people can experience movies and video content either portably or across a variety of things without actually owning the physical media. So it's really been enlightening to me. I didn't think I would ever watch a, quote, high-def movie on something that's streamed, but I catch myself doing that off Netflix streaming media and off Xbox 360's streaming media, where they really advance the cart in terms of dynamic compression of video. And, you know, as a kind of a purist that I am, I'm not always happy about it, but, you know, it's better than what I would watch on standard def, and I can kind of watch it whenever I want, and wherever I want. So those are some attributes that a lot of people really like to take advantage of.
Sure, sure. I'm with you. I'm a purist, you know, in that I much prefer as high a quality as I can possibly get. And yet, I guess, and I must admit, I haven't done that much downloading because of that. I'd rather watch it on Blu-ray. But I guess what you're saying, and maybe I need to sort of rethink this a little bit, is that the quality is coming up on downloaded content.
I mean, it's to experience Netflix or the Xbox 360 video service where it's streaming content is I mean, it's clearly not Blu-ray. But if you put my wife in the room, you know, she has a harder time differentiating the difference between watching a movie on Blu-ray. You and I think we'll always be optical disc mongers. I think my collection now is probably of between HD DVD and Blu-ray. I'm over 1,400 titles that I own on that, and I still haven't been able to watch them, but I still record a lot of stuff via Media Center that's in high def, that stream, you know, that I get over broadcast medium. And I do watch, you know, the Netflix service that I subscribe to for streaming, and the Xbox 360 video service where I can stream and rent high-def movies.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question from Virgil, who asks, which was more compressed, Blu-ray or HD DVD?
You know, that the amount of compression rates that people would use in the formats was largely up to the studios. What you really need to look at was the studios that did both formats, Paramount and Warner. And in the instance of Warner, they use the exact same video encode on both formats. So it was the same. Certain studios would do a lot higher bit rate, which, you know, with the newer codecs, with AVC and VC1, really wasn't necessary. It was pretty much proven that you could go down to average bit rates of like 12 megabits per second and not see any artifacts at all. And instances of those were a variety of Warner titles that they put out. Of course, to do that level of compression takes a lot more time with the compressionist to come up with that level. A lot of studios now with Blu-ray having, you know, always having 50 gigabytes of storage, they can just bump up the average bit rate. But, you know, we've proven over and over again, and also what you can see a lot in the dynamic smooth streaming video compression, that you don't have to have average bit rates in the 20s or the 30s to get a, you know, something that's going to look good on the screens that you and I are used to, you know, 10-foot wide screens, that's still going to look great. At the end of the day, it really gets down to the compressionist, the video tech compression technology they're using, and a lot of that has really been maturing since, you know, the days that we were doing the format war.
Mm-hmm. How's VC1 doing? That was certainly one of the three main compressions schemes that were being used on both formats. And Microsoft, of course, I don't know if they developed that originally, but it certainly was a Microsoft championed compression format. Is that still being used much?
There's still pockets of studios that use VC1. There's still, you know, Microsoft was the inventor, developer of VC1 and put that out there as an alternative to H.264 or AVC HD. And, you know, studios are picking the technology that they see fit most to them. That goes all the way to compression and encoding technologies more than just what the actual video format is. So it's still out there, but AVC HD seems to be the one that's really moving forward, particularly in the Blu-ray format.
Yeah. Jebnor asks, did HD DVD have the same level of DRM stuff like Blu-ray? Keys that change and internet connections and so on? Was it quite a draconian?
The difference that was optional between Blu-ray and HD DVD was what they referred to as BD Plus, which was a technology that added an extra level on top of AACS. Depending on what view you look at, unfortunately, there's been people that have compromised both BD Plus and AACS, and it's kind of a Swiss cheese thing where, you know, the studios are constantly doing new keys, but neither one of those technologies, AACS being mandatory in both Blu-ray and HDVD and BD Plus being optional on for studios to actually use on their titles for Blu-ray, both has been circumvented by, you know, the companies that aren't residing in the United States to provide that technology to break those discs. However, even with people breaking those discs, the unwieldy size of the discs and the way that people have to try to put together those video streams is a pretty large effort to get the same thing that you had on an optical disc, and to have that amount of storage space, you know, while storage space is coming down, it isn't something that, you know, my mom or my my wife or, you know, anyone in my family would go to the lengths of doing. So it's kind of an expensive and time-consuming proposition to be able to rip or compromise ACS protected content, and then by the time if you're going to put it back on the optical disc, you know, the cost of the writable optical disc usually costs more than what you could get that same Blu-ray title on Amazon.com used for. So it's I kind of always question my mind on why people are so interested on doing that instead of just buying the optical disc, which is one of the reasons I really like what used to be called DECE, is now called Ultraviolet. Personally, I think that's a great technology that gets around the complaints that a lot of people had about DRM and how that restricted them, and that it has a digital locker and you can go to a variety of different devices and you don't have to really worry about this, but it still protects the studios from, you know, having something distributed outside of what is, quote, the family or that unit of people that have actually purchased that content.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that much about Ultraviolet, what used to be called DECE. Maybe we might get a screenshot of the website up here, but tell us a little bit more about that, would you?
It's been going on for quite a while. It's a lot of the studios came together and said, hey, you know, what can we do that will provide us a mechanism to, you know, distribute content both in for high definition and for mobile applications, where it can be easy for people to go and get in for, you know, get this content and share it across a variety of devices without being limited to having a disc that might scratch a disc that, you know, becomes obsolete or you don't have a player for it in the car. And Ultraviolet is the official name for what this is. And basically it would allow someone that bought like a Blu-ray disc the ability to have like a digital copy, unlike the digital copies that you see today where you have to put in a code and it comes down DRM protected to your iPhone or to your Windows Media Center device, but something that you could go up and have the option of storing physically. There's a certain number of copies that you can store physically on different devices, either in a mobile format for like viewing on an iPhone or a Zune or something like that, that you could play it back on, all the way to a standard def copy up to a high def copy. And you could store those protected on each of those devices. Or if you were on like a computer and you're in Asia or something and you had your account, you could stream that movie down and watch it in a stream content. So it's kind of purchase rights once for the title, but be able to view it in a variety of different formats and locations that's most convenient for you. And do that easily. Yes, that's the promise around that. And, you know, it's still launching off and still, you know, trying to, you know, really become something that's really well embraced by consumers. But it's something that I've seen that I actually have high hopes on. I've worked with some of the people here at Microsoft that were participating in that and have always been pretty fascinated with what's been going on there. Unfortunately, Disney isn't part of the ecosystem, but all the other studios are there. And, you know, I think that's still a large amount of content that people can get and enjoy in a variety of different locations. I know for one, I will be checking it out once a variety of titles come out and I can play with it to, you know, supplement or replace what I get on Netflix.
Sure. Why do you suppose Disney hasn't signed on?
I don't know the reasons behind that. You know, I used to be pretty up on everything that was going on in Hollywood, but I've just been kind of at a cursory level from the folks that are from Microsoft working on the Ultraviolet effort. So I don't have the exact reasons. I know they have a competing technology that they're trying to do.
Well, that must be it then. Speaking of hard disk space, you were mentioning how, you know, ripping HD DVD or Blu-ray to a hard disk, you know, takes a lot of time and takes a lot of space. And downloading high quality, high def video content also takes a fair amount of space, but also hard disk space is getting pretty cheap. Virgil asked the question, what is the recommended size for a hard drive in a Media Center PC? And what would you consider an extreme amount of storage? I guess the sky's the limit there, huh?
Well, when I, in the team that I've been on here at Microsoft, which was taking Media Center to the Cydia channel, and working with the Windows Media Center team and the Windows and for Windows 7, I was kind of always accused of being a non-normal consumer when it came to, you know, filing complaints and bugs. So the system that I describe at my house is something that you would see more in a custom install type environment. But for me, what I have right now on my Media Center is I have 8 terabytes of hard disk space dedicated to recorded movies and televisions off the broadcast service that I have. And so the premium channels that I have are, you know, recorded on there. And then on my Windows Home server, I'm at 12 terabytes of disk space. And I was just at Fry's, which, if people aren't familiar with that, is a really cool chain up and down the West Coast for geeks like us to go buy things. And I just bought a couple 2-terabyte drives there for $97. So the price point of that coming down and the ability with you know, Windows 7 to do virtual RAID drives on that or adding on eSATA external enclosures and hooking up an external eSATA has really made it a lot easier than the days of back when we were dealing with SCSI and stuff like that to do large fixed array hard drive scenarios that can be viewed as one logical drive. Mm-hmm. So that's what I have. I like to have copious amounts of movies. A lot of things that I have on Blu-ray and HD-DVD, I also have recorded through Media Center from HBO, Showtime, Cinemax, and all those stations. And that's mainly or when family or my wife wants to watch something, they don't want to go into the home theater room and find the nicely organized, alphabetized HD/DVD and Blu-ray titles and then go turn the Blu-ray player on and wait for all that to happen and navigate through the startup sequences to watch the movie. They prefer to just, you know, look at the vast titles that I have electronically stored and then click play and fast forward to the point that it starts and then just watch the movie. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of things double recorded. Personally, I want the high video quality, so I stick with the optical disc, but I do record copious amounts of high def material off the broadcast services and store it via Media Center on hard disk drives. And then I back up a lot of that to my Windows Home server.
How do you get the premium channels, HBO and Showtime and so on? Is that by cable or by satellite?
I have a unique beta system that I test at my house. So I'm doing some things that utilize some satellite services to come in. But majority of people out here in the Seattle area, where it's available, get very good results through what used to be Verizon Fios. Now it got bought out by some other company. And that's I have a lot of friends that use that service, so fiber optic, and they all report, and I've been to their homes, really great video quality, not really compressed at all. Any of the compression they see is, you know, between what those premium content providers provide. And at least on the Verizon networks, the people that I've spoken with and looked at their content, Starz seems to do the least amount of compression over HBO. So I kind of, if I see a movie on Starz and HBO, I'll typically record it on Starz to get a little bit higher bit rate and not so much compression artifacts that I would see on HBO.
Now, can Media Center... Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask if Media Center can interface with Verizon Fios or whatever it's called now. I know that they supply a multi-room DVR head box thing. Can you hook up a Media Center PC to it?
Well, for some of the friends that I have here in the Seattle area that have very nice home theater systems and have a setup similar to what we would do with Media Center, kind of more in the CEDIA channel, is what I have is I have a headless box. So I have a Media Center that sits in the back of the home theater room. It doesn't have a keyboard. It doesn't have a monitor. It just has copious amounts of disk space on it. And it has all the tuners hooked up to it. And then how I watch the content, one option, and kind of the option that, especially now with the new Xbox 360 that's out, that makes it much more viable, is I use the Xbox 360 as a Media Center extender. So in my house, I have five Xbox 360s throughout the house. One's in the home theater. There's one in each guest bedroom. There's one in the master bedroom, and then there's one down in the living room. And then I have HP TouchSmarts that aren't extenders, but they also access the content. And then any of the computers. So any of the rooms we can go to, we can watch all those movies that I've recorded off HBO or Cinemax or Showtime and get them any place. And then, you know, I can pause on one machine and then go up to another room and resume from where I left off. So that's particularly for my wife with our 8-month-old. She'll go from downstairs, pause, and then go up to the kids' room where we have a HDTV in the kids' room, mainly for when we feed him, not for him to be watching. And she can pick up right where she left off there. So that's kind of the scenario that Media Center enables for that. So it's not using the DVRs that the cable companies or optical companies or MSOs or any of those companies or TiVo have for their multi-room DVRs. The Media Center thing is it's all centrally located in one location, and if you want to watch it in multiple locations, you would do that through a Media Center extender. And the ones that I've always used are the Xbox 360s, and particularly now with the new Xbox 360, a lot of the issues and concerns that people in the CEDIA channel had was noise and heat with the
Xbox 360s. Oh, you mean actual like fan noise?
Exactly. And that was a big concern for people. And now the new Xbox 360 that's out, when you're running in extender mode, you can't hear it. It's silent. And that's, for me, I wish that would have been out like 2-3 years ago, because it really would have made a big difference for people having adoption rates on the extender using Xbox. But that issue with the new Xbox 360, outside of it being smaller, is that it's dead quiet when you're running an extender mode, you know, for Windows Media Center. And so to me, that's my favorite feature of the Xbox 360 on the new console that came out.
Right. Silly Chicken asks, what's a good USB TV tuner for Windows Media Center?
I've had good luck with, let me think of the name. I use Aver Media as one.
That's AVER, right?
Yeah, and there's a another one. Starts with a Q. You caught me here.
Uh-oh.
I'm gonna need to. My mind is escaped me on what that would be. But I'll look it up.
You can look it up there. Let me ask you this then: the Xbox 360, the new one, just came out, I guess, right? Some weeks or yes. A month ago or so. We have one question here from the Pab, who asks, what is the next device from Microsoft? Any hints?
Well, you know, people are working, in device in terms of television or in terms of gaming. I mean, I can't really.
Well, no,
there's nothing.
I'm talking about home theater here. This show is, after all, Home Theater Geeks. So, what's coming down the pike from Microsoft in terms of media center, home theater, movies, that sort of thing?
Well, I would say that, you know, one of the most exciting things that I've seen since the majority of people get their video content through cable, or even the people that get it through Fios or fiber over optic, is the new Seton tuner. There's always been a lot of issues, being that ATI was the only digital cable card provider out there, and they didn't have like a multi-tuner solution. And it was, for geeks, it wasn't that expensive, but to get more broadstream acceptance, it was kind of expensive. And Seton now has a 4-tuner and one small PCI card that is just phenomenal piece of equipment. The reliability on it's great. You can, you don't have these 4 big external tuners. You don't have, you know, a slot for each tuner like you had before. The nicest thing about that I like about it is you don't have to have a splitter that goes into each of the 4 tuners, which caused a signal degradation.
Yeah.
You know, when you split up cable, it comes off one and splits it internally and has its own power to amplify that. So it's just one little cable coming in and one little kind of half-height PCI card that you plug in. And they're, to me, that's one of the easiest ways for people to get a very affordable way to get into using a digital cable, both for cable or for fiber optic type solutions. The other thing that's nice is you don't have to buy one cable card, and those usually cost, $2.99. A month to rent per card from the cable company, and now you just have one for all 4 tuners. So you can save yourself some money on that, and it's just a lot cleaner installation. And they've just started shipping those, and that's a startup company here in the Seattle area that's really showing what they can do when they really set their mind to it and kind of going on without any big assistance from us. Those guys really took off and did that. In fact, if anyone goes down to Disneyland, we have in the House of Tomorrow, we have a next-gen technology home that is part of it is featuring Windows Media Center on Windows 7 with HP equipment. And we're using those Seton tuners down there for that. And we have yet to have one service or support call from that. And those things are on every day of the week from about 10 in the morning to 10 at night. Nonstop. And there's 8 tuners that we have going that power up that show there. So to me, that's always one of the big reliability factors is Disney ever calling me up with a support problem around, the technology that we have down there. And there has been not one call from those Seton tuners. So
how long have they been deployed?
we put those in right before Thanksgiving. Mm. So they've been up since before Thanksgiving.
Wow. Wow. How do you spell Seton?
C-E-T-O-N.
Okay. So their website's probably seton.com.
It's setoncorp.com.
Corp. Okay. Let's see. Download Bob asks, any comments on Silicon Dust's HD Home Runner Tuner? Have you had any experience with that one?
I use that in my house also. So I have a total in for my media center in my house. And again, I'm kind of referred to in Microsoft as the non-typical user, but I have eight broadcast type tuners. I have two ATSC tuners and four QAM tuners, all hooked up to one media center box. And for my ATSC and my QAM, I do use HD Home Run's tuner, and I love it. I love the fact that it's networked, and I can just put the boxes anywhere, and I can have those go to like my HP TouchSmart that I have in the kitchen. I use that for QAM and ATSC for my wife to watch anything live that's local, and I have it for TV shows that I don't get off the technology that I'm using to get broadcast television. I use it for the locals and the QAM on specialty channels. My wife's Korean, so in Seattle, there's MBC is a Korean station that's broadcast, and you can only get it over the air. So that's why I'm using ATSC. And on QAM, there's a show for my kid, Kudobo, or I can't remember the name of what he all watches in terms of the cartoons, but it's only available on QAM. I can't get it on ATSC, and I can't get it on the other technology that I'm using. So I use three different types of tuners, ATSC, QAM, and then the special kind of tuner that I've been testing out.
Right.
As a side note, that other USB tuner that I was referring to, it had a Q in it, but it's the 950Q, and it's by Hopog. And that's the two that those are the two that I've had personal experience with is the AverMedia and the Hopog 950Q, and I've used those for both QAM and ATSC. But now I just use the HD Home Runs. I have three of the HD Home Runs in my house.
Mm-hmm. We should explain to everybody in case there are those who don't know these terms. ATSC is Advanced Television Standards Committee. It's the group that put together the HD TV terrestrial broadcast system, which we now use. QAM, Q-A-M, I believe it's quadrature something modulation, is what cable companies use. It's what your cable company uses. And there's QAM, and then there's encrypted QAM. And encrypted QAM is for the premium channels that you have to pay for. And then there's this special one that you're doing with satellite. Is that in conjunction with DirecTV or Dish or somebody else?
I can't say. It's just something. It's something that we've been working on. We work with a variety of people for doing a variety of different things. We're testing out technologies all the time to see who we can partner with and all that. Mm. So it's something that I've been. I'm excited about. I hope there's. Something that we can bring to market, but I can't say anything else.
Okay. What about bandwidth issues around the house? clearly, you need a lot of bandwidth to, you know, send high-def signals from the server to one of the Xbox media extenders. Do you have gigabit around your house?
Awesome. Excellent question. Yes, I have gigabit. You got to have gigabit if you're going to be streaming this kind of high def to multiple locations in the house. There are some documentation that we have on this, on what is the right kind of switch that you want to get. If I wasn't prepared for this particular question, but I'll go find it. There's a particular kind of switch that we recommended in the Cedia channel for use with Windows Media Center. While I'm talking to you, I'll go dig that up.
Okay.
But the key thing is the amount of memory that's in there for switching, and then there's particular settings that you want to set up for the NIC that's on the Media Center that's going to be streaming it to allow for devices that are only 100 megabit, like an Xbox 360 or other devices, so that the flow control works properly. And Nick always had issues.
Sorry, Nick, I just want to say network interface card, right.
That's on the media center computer.
Right.
So those are some of the key things. There's a document that we published for the Cedia channel that I can go dig up and send to you, so you could post it on your site if people want to find out that. But there is there is ways to actually quite inexpensively go about and get this. You know, actually, if I just duck down here for a minute,
get
the Netgear, because I have it here in my office, and then I won't have to look up the thing.
Is
it's
the
GS. Yeah, it's a Netgear GS116.
That's the Ethernet switch.
That's the gigabit switch that we've tested and verified, and I've used it in a couple high end installs, and it's what I use in my house. And I have like four of those throughout my house, but that's the one that my media center hooks up to, and just phenomenal success with it. It has the right amount of memory in it to do the switching for flow control. And then there's just a couple other settings that I put on for the Intel Ethernet NIC Pro 1000 that I have in my Windows Media Center. I found that, or we found that in our testing, to be the most stable and reliable in terms of drivers and everything to be able to stream high-definition video throughout the house.
So the basic configuration is you have a Media Center PC, and coming into that is the signal from your rooftop antenna if you're doing ATSC, or the cable for QAM. And then the Ethernet port on the Media Center PC, that needs to go to the internet, to the Ethernet switch, right?
Mm-hmm.
That goes to your router, or to out to the internet, and also to all your devices in the house. Have I got that right?
That's right. That's correct, yes.
Okay.
The only tricky part around that is, you know, making sure you have a switch that can handle flow control. And you only need flow control set up for RX and TX to be on if you have devices that are 100 megabit. And so if, in my instance, the Xbox 60 only has 100 megabit connection on it. If everything was gigabit in the house, every single computer and every single device, then you wouldn't have these same issues of dealing with flow control. But a lot of the devices still are just 100 megabit that come into them, which is plenty speed to transfer high def. It's when you have one switch and it can't do the flow control and it runs out of buffer in the switch to downgrade from a gigabit going down to the 100 megabit on the device you're trying to stream it to. And that's where people see this glitching or slow copying of files and stuff like that.
Virgil is asking, is there a viewable difference between cable and Fios? I don't have a lot of experience with Fios myself, but I do know some people who do have it, and I've seen it, and it looks really, really good. And with fiber coming into your home, it's got just a boatload of bandwidth. So I'm expecting that it's going to look pretty good. We'll ask Kevin about that as soon as he gets back. Let's see if there are any other questions that I might be able to answer. I don't know of any players that will play HD DVD on the computer. I was going to ask Kevin what he plays his HD DVD on. Probably the Xbox 360, I would guess, because that has or had an HD DVD player add-on, which I always thought was not the greatest idea. I thought Sony got that one right by putting a Blu-ray player inside the PlayStation. And that was a much cleaner, nicer way to go. Of course, the original PlayStation was very noisy, too. Big fan noise problem there, which Kevin was talking about with regard to Xbox 360. But Sony solved that problem as well. So now you've got two really good game platforms with very low noise. Kevin, you back with us?
Yeah, I don't know why I got a... I could see you, but couldn't hear you, and you couldn't hear me.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so anyway, you were saying?
can you help me where I got cut off?
Oh, let's see. Oh, we were talking about gigabit and switchers and so on. I was about to ask you, actually, if you have gigabit Ethernet, or basically as around your house, how many HD streams can you reliably send around at once?
Well, if you look at the average bit rate that we get from broadcast services, I have yet to see any of them really go above a 9 megabit average bit rate. Mm-hmm. And I've tested all five of my extenders streaming high def content through the house, and I've never experienced a glitch ever. So,
and that's, you know, all five receiving at once.
Yes. So, right. You know, that's like 50 megabit, and, you know, I'm a gigabit, so I'm clearly not really in the range of of having a problem. So
even 100 megabit Ethernet then would be perfectly suitable for a few streams anyway.
If you're just doing one stream, we never really saw problems with that. But when we start getting like two or three, then we start seeing other things that were going on. I mean, there's overhead that goes on, and the quality of the switch that you have also comes into play. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like the GS116, I think I bought that for like $199 or something. It's probably cheaper now if you went on the internet and looked for it. But the cost of using those is pretty minimal. And in my home, I just Cat5e, which can do the same speed as Cat6 for gigabit. And I just have had no problems once I switched to that type of a switch and then set up the NIC settings for my Windows Media Center. There's just never been a problem.
What about Wi-Fi? Do you tried that as much or at all, or are you going, eh?
Well, that's a little bit more troublesome thing to deal with. I never really wanted to try it so much in my house because every room was already wired. So, you know, it wasn't something that was of pertinent interest to me to try to figure out. But I have set up family members' homes with Wi-Fi with Wi-Fi N. And I can't say that I've always had the best success in making sure that it's reliable. And that's even, you know, putting N on an Xbox 360. I guess I was disappointed in how hard it is to still get it to work 100% reliably. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, if you have them within close proximity and, you know, you don't have walls in the way and you don't have, you know, and then you want to set up, when you're doing this, you want to set up all the proper security to prevent other people from coming in, which kind of, you know, steals some of the bandwidth and adds some processing onto the overall architecture. I just haven't had the greatest amount of success. There's other integrators that I know that have only dealt with, you know, particular types of access points and particular types of receiving machines and, you know, specific types of distances that have reported having good luck. But, you know, if I tried a variety of type N access points and couldn't always get it to work reliably off to an extender, then I started to become a little bit more disenfranchised. For these family members that I have, they didn't have an option of going wired, and we eventually got it, but I was I had to spend some time, you know, working on it to get it actually to work. So, you know, if you're wired or you can be wired, I would almost say, you know, I would go and spend the $200 to have someone come out and draw the Cat5e or Cat6 cable to that particular room and do it wired and just have no more problems with it versus, you know, the anguish of getting it set up and, you know, who knows what type of interference comes in that might degrade the signal.
Yeah.
So I'm not as bullish. I'm not as bullish on Wi-Fi.
Understood. Got one more question here from Outsider. He asks, where can we find those settings for the NIC card to improve HD streaming when using the Netgear GS116 switch?
Did you say you were going to send that to me? I'll send you the document. You can just post it.
Okay.
It's basically two settings for the NIC. Enable RX flow control off the setting for the NIC. But mm-hmm. I'll get the document for you and I'll send it to you so you'll have that information.
Okay, great. And then we'll put that in the show notes for this particular podcast. And that, I'm afraid, brings us to the end of the hour. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's been very informative, and we didn't get to nearly as much as I wanted to. So will you come back?
Yeah, more than happy to come back.
Great. Wonderful. Kevin Collins was my guest today, and you can find out more about what he does at Microsoft at Microsoft.com/CEinstaller. My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. You can email me at scott.twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Walt Husak, Director of Image Technology at Dolby. And so we're going to get deep into Dolby 3D. This guy knows a lot about it, and so I'm looking forward to learning more about this particular 3D format. So I sure hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out. Thanks again, Kevin.
Hey, you're welcome. Sorry about the, I don't know what's going on with the video or the audio. It wasn't the video.
It wasn't the video. It was the audio. Yeah. How odd.
But I
wonder if it's something at Microsoft limiting things on their network.
It might be because this message came up talking about firewall restriction, but that's strange as we tested it out for like 10 minutes here and we never saw it.
Yeah,
and if it was, why wouldn't it affect the entire broadcast? It was just that one time in the middle, and very strange.
Very strange.
But yeah, we didn't get to a lot of stuff, but I know.
Like, I wanted to get to the HD DVD truck. But we got started a little late, unfortunately, and we are kind of on a hard end time here. So
we'll do it again, and I'll go get that document, and
please send it to me. And John, can we put that in the show notes?
We can certainly put a link to it in the show notes. Yes.
Okay. Great. Fantastic. Well, then, Kevin, I will look forward to talking to you. Will you be at CEDIA?
I don't think I'm going to be at CEDIA this year.
Oh, bummer.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, you're not missing that much in Atlanta. I did not have that much fun there last year.
I wish it would get back to Denver, which it's supposed to in another 2 years, right?
Yeah. What I heard was this year in Atlanta, then 2 years in Indianapolis, and then 2 years in Denver.
Oh.
That's what I heard. So it's not going to be for another 2 years plus that we get back to Denver, which is unfortunate. Oh, well.
Hey, have you... Okay.
Yeah, we'll talk to you later. We got to go. So I'll talk to you later. Thanks a bunch.
All right, bye now.
Bye-bye.